So yeah, this is you interviewing me now, but my leadership book is really based on observation of leaders, because clearly I haven't been a CEO or an MD or even a CTO or a CDO or whatever. But what I have done is worked for loads of different people, including yourself and Stephen. And I thought I'd be really cheeky, basically, and write about my observation of what good leadership looks like to me, but also what I'd like in the future. So,
yeah, but I don't see why that makes you any less qualified than anyone who does occupy a leadership position and writing about it.
Well, no, that's what I figured. I kind of thought, awareness.
observation,
that's what academics do ultimately.
Yeah, so, yeah, exactly. Observe and comment and opine. Yeah. No, I think it's really impressive, actually, that you've sort of put together this sort of portfolio of creative interventions. It seems like a life full of agency.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I'm qualified to talk about any of it, but equally, I'm not unqualified to talk about any of it, if that makes sense. So the last video I did was a bit of an experiment, because I've been watching quite a few of Nadia. My daughter's now 13. So she watches these MCC flow things on Twitch, where there's a series where some kids play Minecraft and Fortnite, basically talk as they go. So they literally do no preparation at all, switch on their camera and speak.
Right.
So I thought, well, all us adults are sitting there getting all like het up about doing all the prep and doing these PowerPoint slides and making sure you know precisely where your conversation's going. But I thought, well, what would happen if I just literally switched on the camera and spoke about a subject that I know? So I thought, well, I'll talk about applying for jobs and the fact that every job, including the one I work for in your organization, every job I've done has turned out to be completely different to what the job description was, or even what the leaders who employed me expected, because sometimes your skills are such that you see the situation very differently when you come in with that picture of expertise. And often it's just like, until you start doing a job, you know, how it plays out depends on your character and what you do with it. So I thought I'd talk about that and just randomly switch on a camera, and I managed to speak for 16 minutes on that subject. So I was like, yay.
Fantastic. Yeah. And actually, a healthy dose of imposter syndrome should really be part of all of our identities, don't you think?
Yeah.
I remember having a conversation with my daughter, Charlotte, a few years ago, where she said, I just have this constant sense of imposter syndrome. And I said, well, I look at this comment from someone who said, either you have imposter syndrome or you're a sociopath. And she said, sociopath sounds pretty good.
Excellent. Well, no, I really like talking to Roger about that, because that's what I interviewed him about. He said he had imposter syndrome his whole career, especially as CEO at TNF. Yeah. I'm like, but TNF, you were CEO for 20 years. I'm not being funny, but how can you feel an imposter for 20 years? And he kind of said, well, he felt it was an advantage, because actually made him aspire to like work harder and be better.
Yeah.
And I thought, actually, imposter syndrome isn't a negative thing if you twist it and make it, you know, to make sure you're the best you can be, basically.
Yes. And that comes back to a sort of general point about how do we frame ourselves and how do we describe ourselves? And the very same experience can be written positively or negatively. And
of course,
knowing one's limitations is actually a great strength, isn't it?
Well, that was why I was really interested in your book about the embarrassment section. This probably hit me harder than anything in a way, in terms of impression that I took away. Because I genuinely don't get embarrassed these days. I mean, I get nervous about things, but not embarrassed. And it is because I assume I'm going to make an idiot of myself. And therefore, you just go into it assuming that, and it's much easier then. Do you get embarrassed would be a good question, I think.
Yeah, the time.
I'm not talking necessarily personally, but professionally.
No, I do. I think just because I'm conscious of, and always have been, about how hard it is to fit in all the time. And I guess I've always felt, to some extent, a bit of an outsider. And so I think I've always got some sort of awareness of it not quite going as probably it ought to. But maybe a bit like you, I'm so used to that, that I guess whether it's conscious embarrassment or just a sort of vague sense that I know I don't quite fit, but that's okay.
But no, I think self-consciousness is kind of different, isn't it? So, so it was really interesting reading your book and hearing you say about applying as Paul and applying as Zia. My brother's name happens to be Paul, so it's quite a solid English name. And I know this sounds really odd, but I worked for you for like 5 years or something. It never occurred to me that Ziad was a foreign name. I know it obviously is, but it was just your name. It didn't register with me that you were particularly, because your accent isn't
exactly
pronounced and your manner and confidence and all that sort of stuff. So I was quite interested, you know, why you came from Lebanon in the first place. And also the contrast in culture. And, you know, I've traveled quite a lot and I've found that the hardest cultural assimilation is when you come back from somewhere. It's actually not when you, so I've lived in Singapore and Ghana and Switzerland and all those places, you assimilate the culture and you kind of go in with this open mind. It's not until you come back home that you think, oh, I don't fit here anymore.
Exactly.
And so I wondered how that translated for you when you came here.
Yeah, it was very relevant. I mean, I was actually born in Baghdad in Iraq and then lived, but no, I did live in Lebanon. And we
also made a complete mistake. That's good then.
Not cool. No. If we moved from Beirut to... Croydon in South London. So definitely a good Beirut to Purley is the phrase I've tended to use.
Yeah,
but,
I saw that.
But I was born in Baghdad because my dad is Jordanian and he was is retired, but he was a sort of contractor and engineer, and Iraq was full of promise and potential.
Yeah.
And he and my mum, who's Irish and he met in the UK, sort of started their lives, their sort of adult lives, working lives in Iraq. And so I was born there alongside my brother and sister. And then we lived, after Saddam turned up, we moved from Iraq to Saudi Arabia and Riyadh, which was a pretty inhospitable place in many ways for us.
Yeah.
And then from Riyadh, we went to Beirut in Lebanon, which was glorious and wonderful and exciting. Right. Until the civil war began. But even then, when it started as kids, I guess we just looked at it as a sense of adventure. I can remember being on the sort of balcony of our apartment, looking out onto the city and seeing shell fire going right, like some sort of surreal tennis.
Fundamentally frightening kind of stuff.
Very kind of, but for us, I suppose, as children, maybe not fully aware of how dangerous it was. In fact, the trigger point that led to us leaving the Middle East was... my parents driving back from a party in the wrong part of Beirut and being shot at having to drive through a roadblock. And so it was quite a sort of dramatic exit. Then we suddenly realized, oh, we better go. We hadn't sort of clocked that it was dangerous.
Right.
Even though the apartment block we lived in was owned by a Syrian family who were gunrunners, and they actually had quite a big arsenal of weaponry. Wow. But somehow,
I'm going to borrow one. It's just very odd.
So if you imagine moving from war-torn Beirut to suburban Purley,
no, it's so different. This is really boring now. What's going on? There's nobody. Obviously it wasn't. But as a child, I think you do look at things quite innocently. I actually lived next door to a Syrian guy who left in that period of war-torn Syria as well. He doesn't really describe it in depth because I think he finds it a real struggle to talk about. But I can imagine coming here and then suddenly being in a completely different culture, but also in a completely different sort of modus operandi is really difficult.
Very much. And not only, the sheer contrast in sort of ways of life, but the cultural norms and, you know, the Paul Ziad story you know about actually has a sort of precursor, because when I first turned up, I went to school. The teachers just decided to call me Paul. They saw I was Ziad Paul Moran. They just called me Paul. So for a year, as a sort of 10-year-old, I'm just being sort of misidentified all the time.
Right.
And I think that I did contribute to a sense of feeling like a fish out of water, that I wasn't able to be the real me. And I think just my mode and style didn't really fit. That's what I mean by that. Having had a sense
also, of the late 80s would have been a bit difficult for any immigrant family. You know, it's like. It was, I grew up in Buckinghamshire. I now live in Oxfordshire. And even here, there's hardly any black people. There's like maybe two in my local community. We have lots of Europeans, French, Italian, all that.
Yeah.
But there are very few people from the Middle East or Africa or, you know, anywhere further.
Yeah. Yeah. And certainly in the bit of London we moved to, which is kind of sort of suburban Surrey-ish. It was extremely vanilla and very sort of, yeah. So it did, it felt, and I think as I noticed as well, just this whole, the sort of Englishy norm of politeness, which I was out of sync with as well. And when I was too argumentative, seemed, you know, so that's one of the ways I think I've always felt.
English
like
people never tell the truth. That's fundamentally
less direct, maybe less direct.
And also, we're always downplaying stuff. So I saw Bill Bailey did a comedy sketch about in Australia or whatever. You ask them how the day's going, they say awesome, it's awesome, like this. And then in England, we basically the best we ever say is not too bad.
It was just
like highlighting.
Yeah, there's a lot of charm, I think, in the sort of habits of understatement and self-disparagement. And I've learned to really admire lots of aspects of English and British culture. It's just I've never quite felt fully part of it. And when there was a time when, so we go back to Jordan from time to time. That's where my actual extended family is. So even though I lived in those other countries, Jordan's sort of our base as a family. And I remember the first time I went with my wife, Kate, there was one evening where my Uncle Najib and Auntie Juliet were having an absolute slam down argument, and Kate was going, oh my God, what's happened? It looks like an absolutely dreadful breakup is going on between these two siblings. And it turned out they were just really arguing about who was going to take us to the Dead Sea the next day, and whose car
they
we
just enjoy it.
It was just very overt and very, and so very kind of contrasting. But I've sort of learned to become anglicized and adapt my ways, and I sound this anglicized, whereas my dad sounds Jordanian and has never fit. And so I'm very conscious
with an accent, you just kind of edited it out, have you?
Yeah, exactly. And I think also the fact that, you know, as I've said in other contexts, the fact that I'm male and pale means that I've actually managed to ride through so much of my time. Even if I've felt like an outsider, I've not really been treated as one. I've actually not suffered the sort of daily indignities that so many people are subjected to. But I do feel I've got a sensitivity to it because of that, maybe.
That's interesting. Because to me, you come across as an entirely confident, good-looking, you know, guy. And honestly, I know it's actually ridiculous that I never thought of your name as being from overseas. But I think it was just because your manner was so integral to
the
company.
There's a thing with naming where it becomes attached to the person. You don't see the name anymore. I remember this because with each time, only twice did I have the kind of arrival of children, because my wife's second pregnancy ended up being with identical twins. But we did all that name stuff, and the amount of debating about what to call the kid I felt the name was so significant. So our oldest kid is called Anna. But after she turned up and we attached the name Anna to her, it was no longer a name. It was just a way of pointing at this individual kid. Yeah. And I think it's a bit like that in a way. These people are just these people, and the name is a way of pointing at them, and you don't really see the name anymore. And I think maybe that's...
Also, there's a thing about... So my daughter, I was going to name after my grandmother, not her first name, because that was Peggy, which probably wouldn't have played out well in this day and age, but maybe it would, I don't know. Her second name is Sylvestria, and when Nadia arrived... I was like, but she doesn't look like a Sylvestria. It's weird. I can't with that name. And she was only one week old at the time we named her.
Yeah.
But I felt that Nadia means hope, and that's an Algerian name. So wonderful. I was like, actually, that seems like a good thing to have. So her second name's Sylvestria. And I figured with a name like that, you can literally do anything, you know, can be a lawyer, an actress, whatever you want.
Yeah.
Because I obviously Googled you when I bought your book.
Hey,
I was very pleased. It was only $9.99 instead of $140.
It's the paperback. That's good. Yeah, I'll ship the paperback.
I saw that you'd written about a couple of sort of, I don't know what you call them, kind of deep subjects, really, about intimacy, interception, and happiness
as well. Yeah, I mean, this issue of we're more complicated than we seem, I think, maybe has its roots in this sense of having been something of an outsider from the beginning, and just realizing that everyone is sort of presenting versions of themselves in the pursuit of feeling validated one way or another. And in the happiness paradox, I was really trying to, as you say, feeling good and being good really are shorthand for sort of two contrasting needs that we have. The feeling good one being more to do with freedom and autonomy and self-expression, and the being good more to do with being justified.
Yeah.
feeling applauded, recognized, taking the audience seriously. And I think those are in very natural tension with each other. And I do think in general, we're always trying to navigate trade-offs and tensions.
Yeah,
our motives are complicated, and we're shaped by social forces, we're shaped by internal emotional forces. And so I think each of these books has been a way of trying to explore that theme of complexity, yeah, okay. I'd say.
And that's, so what age were you when you came here?
I was 10.
Okay. So 10 is quite a pivotal age in anyone's development in terms of being uprooted. I lived in the same house for like my whole young life. But after I was 20, or after I was 18, I actually moved 25 times.
Oh my.
Between then and about 40 odd. And I think that does shape you, because obviously as a young person moving, then you're disrupted in terms of your family, your friends, your familiarity with your culture. But as an adult, you equally have similar things in that your journey points along the way, if you like. So what I've found is I have friends all around the world, but I don't necessarily have a friend I'd call up who lives down the road, you know? So it's a very different kind of relationship with the community. Whereas when I gave birth in Manchester, most of the girls who gave birth at the same time, I call them girls because they were like 21 and I was 35. Mm-hmm. So most of them had local family, local friends, had been to school, and it's a very different community now.
Yeah, very much. Maybe you were getting you've had an early experience of the thing that people are now increasingly feeling, which is this massive distributed networks of relationships.
My social media calendar, if I look at where everyone is, it is literally everywhere. And I can say I'm going to Melbourne or somewhere.
Yeah.
Look up someone who happens to be there and go and have dinner with them. But, you know, it's a different story. I've lived around here for 10 years now. I live in Oxfordshire now. But, it's interesting hearing you say that you felt somewhat disjointed, if you like, from your surroundings as a young person. And then as because I think that's why I don't get embarrassed, actually. Because I've been in so many situations as an adult where I've had to meet new people that I just literally go, right, off you go. And do my sales pitch around the conference centre or locally or with whatever social events are going on. I just don't think about it anymore.
Well, that's a great kind of freedom. Many would wish it. I think you may have come across the anecdote I tell in Judged about the same daughter, Charlotte, who was worried about imposter syndrome, who, when asked the question, what superpower would you like, didn't say, you know, to be invisible or to fly or whatever, the human strength. She said, I'd like the power to make awkward situations go away. And she's so plagued, as most people are, I think, by that sense of anxiety about getting it wrong and not fitting in, and the embarrassment that comes with that, or the shame or the guilt.
So I've been doing quite a lot of stuff about demographics and marketing, but also thinking about kind of a mind map of how I cope with certain situations. Because when you have suffered from mental health issues and been in hospital like me, when I came out of hospital the first time, I genuinely thought I'd just slot back into my life as it was. Mm. And I think it was because I was still a bit. But then the second time I went into hospital, which was shortly afterwards, because I obviously wasn't recovered. When I came out of hospital, I realized I would need to be really, really clinical about how I rebuilt my life and just focus on it, basically. And so in thinking about those sorts of skills that I needed, I call it pulling myself up by my bootstraps. Because I literally went, everyone was telling me it'd take me 5 years to recover, it'd take me a year to, you know, be happy again, whatever. And something in my head just clicked and it just went, nope. And then I kind of systematically approached the rebuilding of my life, which is what I realized I've done in every place I've moved and every job that I've started. I go, okay, first 3 weeks is the hardest. First 3 months, you have no idea what you're doing most of the time. And then after a year, you're pretty much in bed and know what you're supposed to do in any culture environment. But I think the first 3 weeks, especially for me, this is something I realized at Cabbie actually and at Sage, was when I start a job or go to any new environment, I literally absorb everything holistically. I never look at one thing at a time.
Saturated.
It finally occurred to me that I was just overwhelmed by data, actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that can make you feel awkward because you're just like,
yeah. Well, I mean, while traveling around was part of my sort of early life, the only sort of analogous thing I could say in terms of my adult life is moving different jobs within Sage and having very much a similar thing to what you described, with each new job suddenly feeling like overstimulated, flooded with absorption, and then that stabilizing. And I would tend to think 6 months is what it would take before I'd get into a sort of stable rhythm. But it was always a fairly chaotic beginning where in each transition I would find I would almost just work all the time and become very, very sort of frenziedly energetic, and then I'd sort of settle down once I realized it was a marathon, not a sprint.
Well, no, and I think that's a natural coping strategy. So I've been mentoring probably kids of your daughter's age, actually. I don't know how old she is now, but I mentored a 17-year-old recently and a couple of 14-15-year-olds. And they kind of thought that there's kind of a magic equation that you can apply to your life. And I thought it was really sweet, because actually that is what our education system trains kids to do, is to think, you know, I go to university, I come out of university, I get a job, I progress in my career, I probably get married, have a kid along the way. But actually a lot of people's lives aren't linear. And it's all about choice. And so the thing we're not taught in the education systems is what choice, you know, how you manage those choices, but also how you manage the transition into the choice that you've made. And it was really weird. One of the girls, she literally thought if she became a nurse, she would just have to do it basically for her whole life. And I was like, but I've changed careers like 8 times, changed jobs gazillions of times. It's, you know, your life after you leave school is actually pretty exciting because there's no roadmap for it. So it was both inspiring on one side, because the 17-year-old was so excited about her future life and where it was going to go. And I was like, God, I'm 20 years into my career now. I just don't feel that kind of stuff anymore. And then the younger one thinking that, you know, she had to like go on a certain path. And I think it was partly because of her social circumstances. Her family were relatively poor. So I think then that changes your emphasis again. But but it made me realise that actually I've just winged it most of my adult life, which is probably why I've moved so many times.
And probably not many people end up doing what they ever thought they might have. And actually suddenly become aware in their lived reality, there are whole ways of sort of earning a living that just aren't even visible to people when they're younger. It's not, you know, sort of the obvious jobs. Most people's jobs are mysterious.
Publishing leader do, you know, it would be like, what does that mean for your day to day? And I think that's really challenging for people. So my nephew, he's a big into technology. And when he went to secondary school, he did his first year and then he said, right, I'm ready to go to work now. It's like 30. And I said, well, why? He said, because I'm just not interested in any of the stuff at school apart from the technology piece. And so why can't I just like working? He can already program. He's pretty decent sort of technical designer, you know, codes his own stuff and all that kind of stuff. And he was like, all these other subjects are just pointless for me. I can read and I can do maths. What is the point? So, yeah, I think that there is that kind of restlessness in the up and coming generations as well about what is, you know, what is school actually offering me? And all those sorts of things. Yes. We were going to talk about leadership. So this is probably a good segue into talking about leadership, since that, you know, we're talking about culture and learning and how you transition into new roles. So how would you say, you know, I assume you're around like 23 or something when you first got your job in publishing.
Yeah.
How would you say your leadership style's progressed? And what's your biggest learning in that whole 25 years of career?
Yeah, I think it's 32 years now. Right, okay. And I guess it's sort of so many different actual jobs within Sage. So while it's the same company, the company has changed and my role has changed a lot within it. So, and doing sort of being in leadership roles are probably represent the second half of that time. Well, yeah, maybe even more than the second half of it. But I started off as a sort of marketing assistant.
Right.
And then I went into editorial and became a commissioning editor for Psychology and Politics. And then I had to make a leap and became the editorial director and suddenly managing lots of editors. which felt more like management than leadership. It was really trying to get clear about
coordination,
what the desired goals are and that kind of thing. Whereas I'd say in sort of trying to move from management to leadership, and I guess moving a step or two beyond that role where I'm now managing people who are managing people who are managing people.
Yeah, it's a cascade effect.
Then it's a different, and I think then it started becoming more about overarching sense of direction, looking for ways to frame situations so that hopefully you can recruit people's sort of hearts and minds and motivate people. But as I said earlier, it's also knowing what you're not good at and knowing what you need and what other people can provide to round out that sort of those limitations. Yeah. That's definitely something I've sort of felt I've learned along the way.
How would you go about that? Because the one thing I admired you for as a leader, I think different to Stephen and Catherine in a way, they're quite pragmatic people, although Stephen's very academic. You were obviously very intelligent. But I always felt you had your finger on the pulse of culture, which is something I relate to. So I've been called the canary down the mine by a mentor that I had, because I'm so sensitive to culture that I see it as soon as I walk in. And Vanessa, I once called her across when I was by the door of the office. And I just went, you know, and she came across and I said, Vanessa, what's the row this morning? What have you guys been arguing about? And she said, how do you know that? Because you haven't even walked in the door. You've just looked across us. And I always felt that you have that kind of ability where you can read the temperature of the culture, if you like. And
that's nice of you to say. And I to the extent that it's true, I'm really struck by how that's now missing, because in this distributed age, it's so hard to, there aren't rooms to read. So insofar as that was true, I guess I do feel I'm interested in people and how people fit and work together, or try to, or how they don't. And back to that sort of issue of how complicated people are, and try to be more attuned to what's happening between the lines, as well as what's happening on the surface. I think that's maybe one of the characteristics.
So kind of not just what people say, but what they actually feel, think.
The mood, the tone, and the context, I think. Realising that people actually are quite different in different contexts as well. And so trying to bring about contexts in which people feel able to flourish versus ones where they feel they're in a sort of toxic spiral. And I think now that's particularly challenging, difficult, because you can't, you don't have that sort of lived, embodied reality in quite the same way.
So I have spoken to some of your people under coronavirus, not to manipulate or to prepare for this meeting, but just coincidentally.
Interesting.
And one of the things that came across was, particularly for new staff, really difficult. I've spoken to Ian Mulvaney recently, who's at BMJ under lockdown as well. And so the sort of the basics of creating the relationships, engaging your team, you know, navigating through. Also, I think it's been a really strange phase. So I've spoken to a couple of project leader kind of people, people publishing programs, as well as technologists. And most people said everything takes longer because you're not in the office. You don't just bump into someone and have a little chat. But they also said they kind of felt alienated from the rest of their team and sort of socially disjointed, if you like. And I think this is something that Sage always achieved very well, was that there was a definite, not even if you weren't friends with everybody, there was a definite kind of emphasis on friendliness and, you know, having a kind of comfortable living situation, if you like. And I think it, you know, I've worked from home for nearly 10 years, and particularly with Highwire, I was managing Indian and San Franciscan project development technologists and stuff, and translating requirements between them, but also working with clients in the UK. So you're like, the time zone difference for one is a nightmare. Developing the user stories and the requirements for a piece of technology can be really complex. And then even then, when you think you've got the test criteria down and the description down and everything's fitted together, then the person in India slightly develops that bit differently to the person envisioned in San Francisco. And then they get together and talk and they do whatever they need to do to make it right. And then you present it to the customer in the UK and they're like, what? this isn't anything like we wanted. And it's just like a real detail thing that is just almost, you know, until the teams are networked in and sort of collaborating really closely, the first couple of like iterations can be a nightmare. And I think that's really come across, the frustration, if you like, of communication and the amount of communication.
And I think you can broaden the thing. You know, a lot of commentators just talking about a sort of crisis of connection looming in general, the sort of rise of sort of loneliness and alienation. I'm thinking of these, of two books in particular. One is one by the journalist Johan Hari, a book called Lost Connections, and it's a lot of it talking about depression. And how depression is circumstantial and how people need reciprocal relationships. And then there's the LSE academic Narina Hertz. She's just published a book called, I think it's called The Lonely Century or something like that. But it's...
That sounds really cheerful.
Actually, she...
If you weren't depressed before this book, you will be now.
And she extends it into a sort of a critique of sort of neoliberal sort of cultural norms, but also really does dive in quite deeply into this, what's missing when you're actually on screen. And there's a long list of discussing people last night.
It's something about, so have you read Notes on a Nervous Planet by Matt Haig?
No.
So he essentially says social media is massively increasing our anxiety. Partly because, you know, everyone posts the good things, nobody posts the bad things, basically, or hardly at all. But also for kids, the dopamine release when you get a text or a like or whatever is actually physically addictive. It's not just, you know, it's not just on the screen. So Nadia said to me, Mum, I've got my reading figures for TikTok this week. It was the last week of lockdown before they went back. She said, I've spent 45 hours on TikTok. And I was just like, oh. But I think everyone reached a point under lockdown where you've done all the sort of obvious things with your kids and kind of exhausted every avenue of entertaining them. And everyone just kind of went, oh, last week doesn't really
whatever. Yeah, absolutely.
But it is quite interesting because when she went back to school, and I think I found this, you know, I did a contract in the summer. You're not used to social interaction. And I, because I'm a single parent, then the only person I really spent time with in some of that time is Nadia. And so you just don't have the mechanisms anymore to talk to people. But it's also quite exhausting to be around people. Whereas previously you might be an extrovert and therefore energized by it. You just think, actually,
I came across a new acronym, which was JOMO. So we all know...
Joy missing out.
Yeah, that was news to me. I'd always been aware of FOMO, but JOMO was, I think, a description of what you're talking about now.
Well, no, but I think that's what people maybe have gained in appreciation. So yes, there's been challenges with work. So rather than working from home, some people call it living at work, which I think is a really good point. I mean, my routine is if I come into my office and put my shoes on, then I'm working. As soon as I go out the office, close the door, then I'm gone and I switch off.
Good.
Otherwise, it just consumes your life.
Yeah.
But I also think there's a thing about, you know, we haven't been going to Legoland or the zoo or the wherever or going to town. And so you've got a closer relationship with my daughter in one way.
Yeah.
Which is that we spent a lot of time together talking, you know, doing the camping outside, all that stuff. But there's also the pain points of any relationship come up because, you know, you're thrown together. And so anything that was irritating you before is kind of amplified.
It's a bit of a pressure cooker.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. So in terms of mental health, when she went back to school, then, you know, she just said, I'm just socially because there's 300 people around me. And it's just
not attuned.
But
what you say about sort of junior people trying to find their way in an organization, I do feel very concerned about that, because I think people who've been around, and like I have in the same organization for ages, have sort of lots of cultural capital to draw on. Whereas if you're coming in fresh and you're trying to make connections, and all that learning that happens by osmosis and diffusion and overhearing and chatting that you were describing earlier, we've started getting people back into the office a bit, purely on a voluntary basis. Mm-hmm. But we did have last week a 2-day session called Sage Fest, we called it, and it was a bit like Freshers Week at university.
That's
we
a good had idea.
And stands. Sort of more than 200 people came on both days, and it was, you know, me at the senior.
Really fun, actually.
It was actually. It was. I felt very exhilarated about it, and it did remind me of the things that that I've missed in terms of the culture that I've sort of valued in the past.
No, because I always felt. I don't know if this is true now. I assume you've sustained this kind of culture, but I always felt working at Sage is the most liberal place I've ever worked. I felt that the leaders and just people in general were very accepting of difference and the different characteristics, you know, whether, you know, racial differences, ethnicity, LGBT, all those kind of things were very accepted and just normal. And I think that was before all the conversations started. You know, Black Lives Matter and the growth of pride and stuff over the last 10 years. I felt, as an organisation, I always felt Sage attained that really well. And I wondered whether that's a deliberate choice from the leadership.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that was your perception. It's interesting to reflect on sort of whether that was the lived experience of everybody within it. I think that was, but definitely we've had a sort of veneer of goodwill and friendliness, as you describe, but I think the lived experience is something which I think maybe after these inflection points, such as Black Lives Matter and the murder of George Floyd, has brought to surface a lot of sort of trauma and pain that people have been carrying that they maybe didn't even feel allowed to access to talk about. Yeah, it just wasn't legitimated, and I think there's a very powerful change in our culture and absolutely within Sage's company culture, but I mean the culture at large as well, which is pulling away from the sort of tendency towards complacency that could easily arise when people just are feeling like they're being quite friendly to each other.
Yeah.
So it's very, I think there's a powerful shift going on, and I think it's a reckoning, which is really important. And is, you know, hopefully will turn into action and not just sort of warm words and good intent.
But
I think more broadly about the culture, which I think is something distinctive about Sage and is true, is I think the fact that we're privately held by...
Yes, makes a big difference.
Owned by the very same woman who founded the company when she was a 24-year-old, Sarah. That is actually a very enabling thing, and why so many of us have been there for so long, because we know that she's always been sort of passionate about the mission of the company to such an extent that she'll never sell it and has arranged her sort of...
Okay, well, she's put it in trust or something.
It's just quite, and it's sort of easily said, but difficult to do. Not many people do that.
That actual ethical, moral approach.
She's just obsessed about, the dissemination of usable knowledge. That was the phrase that she used right at the beginning. We now talk about building bridges to knowledge, and she's obsessed about the social sciences. And when I'll be presenting to, I've got my first trip to the States coming up in a few weeks' time.
LA.
And we'll go up to Santa Barbara for the board meeting. That's where Sarah lives.
Yeah.
And I know that she'll be looking at me across the board table as I'm presenting, and with that same look in her eye, which is this still recognisably the same company I founded 55 years ago?
Yeah.
And I think that has definitely been quite a good organising principle. By no means are we the kind of the healthy version of the culture I'd love us to be, for the reasons I was saying earlier.
Yes.
But I do think that's enabled us to be quite long term, and it's recruited people who are also passionate about that mission too.
Well, I think that the I'm not ready to speak clearly, but the sentence I was trying to say was the difference between Sage, I mean, CUP had this as well, to be fair, and TNF to a certain extent, but TNF is way bigger, so it's harder to do this, is that Sage always encouraged honesty in expression. And one of the things that I always appreciated was, even when I was absolutely petrified at raising an issue with someone, and whenever I did, then that person would respond in a positive, listening, affirmative way. And I think that is the key to any culture, because the worst employment cultures I've worked in were when that kind of honesty is absolutely discouraged and you're pushed down, alienated, and made to feel very small and stupid if you express any problem. And actually the companies that fail, I think, are the ones who operationally, you know, in their culture and in the sort of practicality of the organization, just refuse to look at problems. Yeah. And you know, because I've worked, I mean, I worked in customer services in CUP. I set up a warehouse in Singapore for them. I obviously worked for you, and I've worked for TNF and did the Aspon migration with them, you know, back in the day, 10 years ago. And in all of those circumstances, had people not been able to raise concerns and genuinely be listened to and genuinely have those concerns addressed, then all of those projects would have fallen over. And the other, so there's two manifestations of that going really wrong. One is that projects fall over, and clearly, you know, that loses money. But equally, the sort of manifestation of it I've seen in a few organizations is where a manager or leader literally loses every member of their team. And often it's within a very short space of time. And it's really clear that it's not the people leaving that are the problem. But often it's seen as being them leaving that's the problem. And then you just think, actually, no, it's the person they report to. And I think like 70% of people on Glassdoor and all of those kind of exit interview based sites, are, it's about the person they report to that's the biggest
problem. Yeah, I'm very glad you had that experience at Sage and that you felt able to do that, to speak up and to feel that you would be heard. I don't know if people would say the same to that degree now. But again, partly this slightly sort of atomized, distributed world, partly also the fact that we've sort of grown and complicated ourselves as a business. We're about sort of 2,000 people across sort of five major hubs globally. And I think those growing pains have kind of shown through. And I think, you know, so we have lots of debates about sort of, let's make sure we're capable of radical candor and not be too conflict averse and so on. And quite often that whole debate about if people do speak up, do they then become sort of seen as being too sort of argumentative? Whereas I would rather everyone just had strong voices. I'd rather people felt free to speak up. That's my own sort of.
It's usually the quietest voice that is going to say the most important thing you need to hear. But if everyone drowns them out, then they're like, Well, I think that problem is something that Taylor and Francis particularly would have had. That they have 5,000 people across the world, approximately. And I didn't talk to Roger Horton about this, but I have noticed it. And it's almost like to lead and manage a culture of that size. One of my friends has 1,000 people reporting to him. I think it might have grown since then, 1,000 people. And you're just like, you cannot possibly have a personal relationship with all of those people. And you certainly can't dictate or influence or demand things of a specific. So one of the things that came up in the organization I worked for was, who owns your LinkedIn profile? Is it you as an individual, or is it the company you work for? Now, absolutely, in my opinion, it's totally me. I get the choice of how I present myself on LinkedIn. But as soon as a company starts to try and influence the way you behave on those social media channels, as soon as you try and influence people in those environments, that's where the animosity comes through. And actually, it's really clear which companies succeeded under coronavirus and which companies were struggling because, or to me, from the outside anyway, and I think I read it right, was that if people are actively posting, either, you know, repeating sort of promotional stuff, marketing stuff, or just saying, you know, this is the role that we're promoting at the moment and actively doing that from their own back, then your culture is probably pretty strong. But there are some companies under, and this isn't Sage, I have seen people from Sage post, so don't worry. But there are some companies that literally died on social media during lockdown in terms of there was a repost and reflections and positive, you know, even just liking a marketing post or something. And I felt that that really demonstrates the kind of disjointed feelings that a lot of people had. And I think when you reach, so I'm garbling a bit here, but when you reach a certain size, all you can do is kind of cascade out the culture that you want to manifest.
Yeah.
And if you try and kind of wrap your hands around it and try and direct it in any way, then people start to feel controlled rather than supported. Mm. And that's a really difficult balance.
Are you familiar with Dunbar's number?
No, I've heard of Dunbar.
He's called Robin Dunbar. He's an academic who, I think sort of anthropology stroke psychology.
Right.
He came up with this number of 150.
Right.
Being the sort of size of a village, yes, and the way you can operate functionally in a sort of social setting.
Yeah,
yeah. And that's sort of the number of sort of meaningful ties you can have to people. And beyond that, it very quickly becomes something else. And I do think we have scale issues that I think he correctly identified.
Well, and it's really difficult because it's kind of an atmosphere. So I always think in someone like Taylor Francis or in Sage, actually, the people who manifest your culture aren't necessarily your middle managers or your leaders. What they are is the people on the ground.
Mm.
And so your editorial assistants, your marketing assistants, your supervisor in customer service, all those people manifest culture because they're the masses, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And if they don't buy into the direction that the company's going or understand it, and you haven't distilled it down to a level which is communicable to somebody who's just joined, say, then that's where it becomes impossible. And I think some of those things come from very simple things, like, which you would have been missing under lockdown, which is like at Taylor & Francis, there's a cricket team.
That's it.
And Roger Horton used to play for the cricket team. And every time one of my friends in my department came back from playing cricket with him, she would always come out glowing and positive about something exciting that's happening in the company. I was like, that is one person that he's influenced. And so in a weird way, he wasn't always influencing down from the
top. That's right.
He was kind of touching points.
Yeah.
And influencing across.
Very different now. Now you can do sort of chats like this, but on the whole, that sort of lived experience, that embodied humanizing sense is very hard to come by. And so, as you say, the culture is carried by the sort of largest populations, and they're not walking through the door in the same way. They're not looking around and seeing this is how it feels and I feel like I belong. They're logging on, and could be often logging on to any company sometimes.
Yeah.
So I think our culture is definitely becoming thinned out, attenuated. I don't know how easily it'll start to self-repair, but I do feel that the in-person connection is a very important part of the equation. There are huge benefits that come from the distributed as well, obviously, but I do wonder if our culture is thinning out because of the lack of human contact.
I mean, the problem is as well, in terms of engaging with those people, is probably the marketing assistants and the editorial assistants. They're the least likely ones to be on the Zoom calls. And they probably are having their one-to-ones with their manager and everything every week, but in terms of a more aggregated view, that's why I was quite interested to hear about your 200 people coming to, you know, a social and informative day. That does rebond those people.
Yeah, that was what it was there for. It was so successful, we're going to do it again in a sort of smaller way on a more regular basis, and just say we've laid on lunch, there's sort of refreshments and drinks in the evening and whatever, and come along, and it's not about working, it's coming just to bond.
I also heard that some of your team have moved to Manchester, which I was quite interested in by. And I thought, actually, that's a fundamental difference, because if they used to come in the office and now they live up north, then
a lot of people have just moved to a life setup that's better for them. And so that sort of embedding of the remote or the hybrid working practice is here to stay.
Yeah,
I mean, if you think about it, because we've been this sort of globally distributed company anyway, you know, 4 out of 5 people who reported to me from the moment my life went global, which is about 10 years ago, we're all based in California.
Yeah.
And so there is a thing I mean, but we'd see each other a lot, so you'd form the relationships, but you wouldn't be in the same office. I think the, but a lot of people have moved to all over the UK and to other parts.
So then you're in that kind of work anywhere kind of culture. So there's an increasing tendency, increasing trend, if you like, to unlimited holiday, which is quite interested in a couple of companies that I saw. And the other is work anywhere for our company. So you can literally travel as you work or whatever, and you can, but all you have to have is an internet connection. And I think that will become more and more prevalent. The holiday thing where you can have as much holiday as you want, apparently that causes people to work harder in most instances. And they actually take less holiday than they would normally. So I was like, that's a weird trend. I think it's just, you know, your anxiety of
the conventions and the norms. It's not truly licensed. You could do it, but it's
The thing that I was interested in, I was thinking about this with conferences. We did an interview with Cadmore Media and Mark Carden a few months ago, saying that if you're in a globally distributed work anywhere team, then your 200 people coming into the office is completely impractical. So how do you manifest that kind of relationship building? For me, being, I've been a salesperson quite a long time, so not going to conferences and being able to do your elevator pitch to someone and just having a chat with them is really hard to replace. So when we were talking about this, talking about actually, could you have an avatar-based kind of interaction? Could you have a kind of tap on your shoulder sort of situation where someone's, you know, lots of kids have stuff like a friendship bus stop and a friendship bench at school. Is there some mechanism like that that allows you to interact and network with people?
Yes.
I think in order to produce a 2,000
virtually or
distributed teams, impossible.
Yeah, you start talking about virtual mechanism. Yeah, we use one called GatherTown. I don't know if you've heard of GatherTown.
I've heard that one.
Yeah, it's really good. I actually learned about it because we did this thing we do this thing each year at Facebook, and the various tech people there all kind of use it. And the idea is it sort of almost recreates the feeling of being an analog person. So yeah, you do have an avatar of yourself walking around this town. And if you approach a room which has other people in it, they suddenly become audible to you as you get closer.
Like a genuine conversation thing.
And then you're in, then you can walk away and then they can fade out again. And so you actually are sort of recreating that slightly analog experience. And it seems to be much liked. I mean, I played with it back early in the year, but a lot of teams do actually meet on GatherTown.
Yeah, and so if, because I think if you have that sort of cultural method of interaction, and if that becomes more and more prevalent across our industry, then when you join another company, you're going to be used to those tools. Because I think one of the things that sort of blew everyone's mind when coronavirus hit and lockdown came was not just the working from home as a habit, but the fact that your routines are totally decimated. Your previous working style has just disappeared overnight. And suddenly there were people who literally spent their entire time in their own flat, on their own, isolating from everyone, and then only talking to people through Zoom. And that was where the loneliness and isolation, I think, kicked in really hard. I mean, it's all right for a month, but after a month, most people got really worn down and quite depressed about it. I think people weren't used to working from home anyway.
Yeah.
But you think the more it becomes a norm that you do have a kind of work anywhere policy or then hopefully that will become increasingly comfortable for people.
The thing I would say, and I just want to do a quick time check as well, actually, because I think about 12:30, I'm pretty good at jump. But I was reflecting on the fact that we don't really know what's happening to us yet. It's not it's not written. And one of my sort of passionate interests is the sort of social science imagination, and want to know what will the social scientists make of it when they look back on it. I feel the first draft of history is being sort of written, and then the second draft of history will be of what actually happened, will be analysed by the social scientists.
Yeah.
And eventually in 50 years' time, the historians will come in and tell us what really happened. But I do feel that we don't even know what's going on right now. I don't think we even have a good grip on it. But I'm hoping that the social scientists will start giving us insights, because I think that they are sort of a lot of the people I kind of respect most highly and have influenced so much of my own thinking, both at work and at play and writing and in every way.
One of my favourite things that I've seen.